900 AM, the talk of the Palm Beaches.
Are you retired or nearing retirement? By now you probably realize that nest egg you had set up is not nearly enough to carry you through retirement. Here's some good news. Fortitude Investment Group can help. They specialize in retirement planning, estate planning, income taxation, and investment strategies for people who are retired or approaching retirement looking for ways to maximize their income. It's not too late to get on the right track to financial freedom. Mark Linsky has been a financial advisor since 1986 and carries a certified financial planner's designation and all the tips, tools, and secrets you need to find financial stability. They also focus on 401k plans and passive real estate solutions. So whether you're retired, nearing retirement, or just want to stay ahead of the game, contact Mark Linsky at Fortitude Investment Group today to set up your consultation. 561-328-7391. That's 561-328-7391. Fortitude Investment Group, US 1 and Donald Ross, right in Juneau Beach.
Fortitude Investment Group is an independent firm with securities offered through Summit Brokerage Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services offered through Summit Financial Group, Inc., a registered investment advisor.
Shalom, friends, and welcome to The Schmooze with your hosts, Rabbi David Vigler and Mitchell Zachary.
Separating the facts from the fiction and the Bubba Mises from the bottom line. Good morning and welcome to The Schmooze in this beautiful, sunny Florida morning. Our friends and family are all up in New York this weekend. We're having this beautiful international women's convention for Chabad Rebbetzins and lay leaders in the Chabad communities around the world. Can you imagine? It's taking place in New York City this weekend, where you're having 3,000 or 4,000 Jewish women, all of them in leadership, coming up to one united convention where they're representing communities from every single corner of the globe, from Vladivostok in Russia to Uruguay, from Anchorage, Alaska to Zanzibar in Zimbabwe. It's really incredible. And I got to tell you that Chabad has got to be the most female in leadership organization, certainly in the Jewish world today. Harry, have you ever thought of that concept before? You know, people talk about Jewish feminism. People talk about women in leadership. In the Chabad movement, you just take a look at what's going on over there. You've got these women that are leaders of the world's most largest Jewish organization with 4,000 centers around the world. And every single one of them has a woman in leadership. Can you imagine? Have you ever heard of such a concept?
It's truly amazing.
It really is touching. You know, I got to tell you, I just received a picture on Facebook from one of our women leaders in the community. She's freezing. She's absolutely freezing. But she's enjoying the snow. I mean, these guys are fighters. These guys are ladies who are so strong, so proud of who they are. Nobody stands in their way. And just want to take the hat off, not the yarmulke, but the hat off to these women, to our Rebbetzins, and to our women lay leaders who are incredible forces in our communities across the globe, from Australia to Alaska, from Siberia to South America, and from South Africa to Scandinavia. Hey, that's pretty good rhyming over there. Made it up on the spot. And I really take my hat off to them, to salute them and say yeshe koach for an incredible, incredible show of leadership that's going on in New York today. We here are in Florida, where we are identifying with our brothers and sisters up north. It is freezing cold here too. We're down into the freezing 70 degrees, freezing cold 70 degrees here, 60 maybe, and we can identify with them as well. We've got a very, very special, very special guest this morning in the studio, and this is an extraordinary, extraordinary opportunity. Besides for Mitch Zachary, of course, who's the CEO and the co-host here of Schmooze Radio for the past 4 years at least.
I think it's been over 4 years.
But Mitch, you're part of the show here.
Thank you.
Our guest this morning in the studio is one of the most powerful and influential people in the United States of America. This is a big deal. This is no jokes. He is a Supreme Court judge in the state of Michigan. He also has a special Florida connection, a connection to Palm Beach Gardens, because his parents are part-time residents here in Palm Beach Gardens. And Richard Bernstein, Michigan Supreme Court judge, is actually a very young guy. It's amazing. He's like my age almost. He's a little bit older than me. How old are you, Richard?
42.
Yeah, I'm 35. Not so bad, right? That's pretty close. He's a young guy, and he's one of the most powerful people, certainly in the state of Michigan, probably top 10 in the state of Michigan, I'd guess. But in this country, he's definitely one of the most influential, one of the most powerful people. And we've got this extraordinary gift of having Richard right here with us in the studio. He was our guest for Shabbos, and we're so incredibly grateful for that. Richard Bernstein, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Shmooze Radio.
Well, Rabbi, it's a pleasure to be here, and I want to tell you, I have so enjoyed being a part of your community. We had a wonderful event at the shul on Friday, and you have...
You blew us out of the ballpark in Friday night, by the way. You know that, right?
Well, that's very kind of you, but you have a wonderful community of people, and of course, we want to give special attention to Gail Cooper, who is the person that kind of helped to bring us together.
Absolutely.
And allowed for this all to happen. So it was a beautiful dinner to be there, and it was a wonderful tribute to Gail, who made this all, and Arthur, of course, who made this all happen and brought us all together. But I just have to say, though, that you have an amazing group of people within your community.
Thank you.
Warm, kind, energetic, passionate, just a delightful group of people, and you should be very proud of the community that you've created and the impact, I believe, that your shul is having on the Palm Beach Gardens area.
So, Richard, let me just fill you in over here. We had, a community Friday night dinner on Friday night as part of our Scholar in Residence series. Richard was our extra special guest this Shabbos. And what's amazing is that we have a community of people that are just yearning to be inspired. Isn't that amazing to have a group of people that just want to learn? They want to be inspired. They want to be uplifted.
Well, that's why they come to shul.
That's right.
Just to see you.
And Richard just absolutely fit the exactly what the doctor ordered. I'm getting these most beautiful text messages from people about after Shabbos, of course, about how much they enjoyed. You know, last week we had another special guest. We had Sassi Reuven, who was an Entebbe raid fighter.
Wow.
He was one of the IDF
soldiers. Wednesday.
On Wednesday, exactly. He was one of the IDF soldiers who was on the airplane that liberated the hostages at the Entebbe raid, at the Entebbe airport on July 4th, 1976, which, of course, was the bicentennial celebration of the independence of the United States of America from 1776. And this guy writes me a message. He says, Rabbi, you know, I've been with Chabad for many years, and that event on Wednesday night, that was just like the best event ever. That speaker was so incredible. I never imagined that you'd ever be able to top that. But then, 3 days later, you got Richard Bernstein, and he was the cherry on top. So, Richard, thank you very much for being our Shabbos guest this week. But I want to tell you something extraordinary about Richard. You see, Richard isn't just a Supreme Court justice in Michigan. He's not only a guy who, as a lawyer, took on some of the most powerful companies in this country to court and succeeded in suing them, including Delta Airlines, the City of Detroit, University of Michigan, and some other heavy hitters that he sued in order to fight for the rights of people with special needs. But Richard himself is a special needs person. He is a person who was born with one gift lacking, and that was the gift of sight. Richard, can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Oh, sure. Well, I was actually born blind, and I think that why that is so enjoyable for me to be a part of Chabad is that I think what Chabad really teaches, and I think the incredible values of Chabad, are that as long as you have faith and as long as you have belief, that Hashem will always give you what you need when you need it. And I believe that is really the essence of what Chabad teaches, that I find to be so powerful, and the gift that I think the rabbi gives to people who come to synagogue. It's the idea that you have to take the first step. You have to believe. You have to put yourself out there. But so long as you're willing to do that, then Hashem will ultimately allow for you to get to where you need to be. And I think that the beauty of, I think, having such a strong, vibrant Chabad here in Palm Beach Gardens is that life is all about experiences. And we talked about this on Friday, but I think what happens is that you have to embrace the experiences that Hashem gives to you. And the more experiences that you have, whether they're good experiences or bad experiences, but the more experiences that one has, the better their life ultimately is, because it makes it fuller. It makes it more meaningful. It makes it more passionate. It gives it more purpose. And I think ultimately, you know, especially for folks that are, you know, in your community, they have been blessed with some challenges and struggles, but it's through those struggles that they have gained a tremendous experience, understanding, appreciation of life, the world, but most importantly, their ultimate place in it.
Richard, can you elaborate a little bit? What do you mean that life is all about experiences? I just want to understand this. You know, Richard is a smart guy, by the way. This is a guy who had to memorize his way through law school. You know, we had a teenager on Friday night who asked Richard how he was able to study. And he said, yeah, we'll just memorize it. And this guy's eyeballs popped out of his head as he realized, oh my God, you know, I can barely make it through my homework once. And this guy does it 5, 6, 7 times until he actually memorizes it. So Richard, what do you mean by that?
Well,
when you say that life is about experiences, obviously we all experiences.
Sure.
Can you elaborate, please, what that means?
Well, I think experiences are what allow for you to kind of impact other people in certain ways. I mean, you know, and it's interesting, and I use this on Friday, but I think it's a really good thing to look at, which is that question about what are the qualities that make a good judge. You know, if you're going to sit down and ask, you know, okay, what is it that would make an excellent jurist? What makes them a better judge? And we had that discussion about, you know, this conversation I had with people who help to choose judges, and, you know, their perspective was that good judges are ultimately determined exclusively based off of your publications or your curriculum vitae or your academic experiences. And it was interesting because my response back to that is that, well, don't you think that life experience is what really makes a good judge? And
wow.
what I mean by that is that, you know, ultimately, look, you know, the best judges are the judges who have the most life experience, not the best curriculum vitaes, but they have an understanding, they have an appreciation of challenge and difficulty and hardship. If you have people that are serving in high positions who really don't understand empathy or compassion, or who don't appreciate the struggles or difficulties or hardships that real people face on a daily basis, you don't really want them sitting in those positions because they're not going to have an understanding.
Richard, can I stop you there? I mean, this is so validating. It's just so validating. I just want to reset.
Mm-hmm.
When you're listening to the Shmooze, you're separating the fact from the fiction and the Baba Mises from the bottom line. It's the rabbi and the CEO. Mitch Zachary is the CEO. I'm Rabbi David Vigler of Chabad of Palm Beach Gardens. And we're talking to a very special person in the studio today. It's Michigan Supreme Court Justice Richard Bernstein, who was born blind. He does not know the meaning of the word disability. This man, it's amazing, you know.
Nothing stops him.
There's this comic going around on a cartoon on Facebook somewhere. You see a person, huge, very, very big person, is riding a donkey, and it says, "If you ever think you're having a bad day, then think of this horse. Think of this donkey." You know, seriously, you know, when you think you're having a bad day, you know, you always got to look at somebody who's got less than you. If you think that you're struggling financially, if you think that you're struggling in one way or the other, then try to think of what life would be like without having the ability to see. For Richard Bernstein, he doesn't even know the meaning of disability. For him, it's like a platform, as he just described, experiences. This makes me into a better judge because I know. That's what he's saying. He's saying, I know what it means to have challenges, what it means to be the underdog, what it means to be, you know, to be in a difficult situation. So when someone stands before him in court, I hope he's going to elaborate on this a little bit more, but if somebody stands before him in court, he's like, you might be able to identify, I guess, empathize with why the guy was stealing in order to support his family, maybe. I don't know. I mean, maybe you could elaborate on that, but to me, this is extremely validating to see that you're saying that judges don't need to be just academically smart. They need to be emotionally smart. They need to be able to empathize. They need to have the experiences of struggle and challenge in order to be able to truly judge.
The wisest judges are the kindest people. And quite candidly, is that you can overcomplicate something to such an extent that you can get to resolutions or get to results that hurt people. Sometimes overcomplication allows for you to do things that can be very harmful to individuals and be harmful to people and to ultimately be unjust. The most simplistic decisions are usually the most just, which means that at the end of the day, you know, being a judge, there really goes to what is people's fundamental understanding or appreciation of fairness. And I think when you can understand what fairness is, then you can have a better appreciation and perspective of justice. And ultimately, like, my perspective of this is that, you know, in the Supreme Court, there are seven judges that sit at a table that make determinations that literally affect the lives of millions of people. It affects people's freedom. It affects people's environment. It affects people's education. It affects people's livelihood. So every decision that it affects people's families. I mean, for all intents and purposes, every decision that is made at a Supreme Court level has far-reaching implications on millions of people who inhabit the state of Michigan. And I think what is critical is that if you were to have seven people and they were all the same, they all had Ivy League backgrounds, they all had very fancy curriculum vitae, but they didn't have life experience, then I think what would ultimately happen is the people would not be best served. You need those different perspectives. You need those different understandings. You need those different appreciations that go into how you make decisions to make sure that the law is interpreted in a way that is truly fair and that is truly just.
Richard, would you be able to elaborate to us a little bit on some of your most interesting cases that came across?
Well, we've had, a number of interesting cases. Now, of course, I can't talk about any pending cases, but I am allowed to talk about cases, you know, that have ultimately been decided.
And especially cases that would have been impacted by your, am I allowed to call it disability, or what do you call it?
I wouldn't say that it's disability. What I would say is awareness.
Such a beautiful way your challenge.
I think that's what really is my hope in terms of what we're able to bring to the bench in Michigan, which is, and I think really, you know, just to go back a few chapters before you get to actual cases, I think what we have to look at is, number one, I think we have to realize what a great state Michigan is. Michigan is a really wonderful state. I'm just going to tell you.
Say this in Florida.
I will just tell you, it is, Michigan is...
You're born and raised in Michigan?
Born and raised in Michigan, but Michigan is really just a nice Midwestern state with really wonderful Midwestern people. And I think that the reason I say that to you is that we have to, let's look at a little context. We have to look back, and Chabad has always been good about this, and that's why I'm such a supporter of Chabad, because Chabad does the friendship circles all across the country. And the first friendship circle, as you know, Rabbi, was established by Rabbi Shem Tov in Detroit, Michigan, in West Bloomfield. And it's now served, which is remarkable. I was at a friendship circle event in Phoenix, Arizona. This is Phoenix, Arizona. They had 2,000 people at their walk for friendship. So what was spurred on by Levi and Bossy Shem Tov in Detroit, Michigan, has now become a national and international. They have one of the strongest friendship circle chapters in Sydney, Australia. Yeah. It has thousands of people that are like part of it. So this is just an example of how Chabad kind of sends its mission all across the nation, if not across the world. And it really has transformed how people with disabilities are treated. And it's a tremendous impact that Chabad has had in the lives of countless numbers of people who do have special needs. But I think what we have to do is we have to go back a little bit, and we have to realize that 50 to 75 years ago, if you had a disabled child, the traditional course was that that person would be placed into a state-run institution. That was pretty much the general direction that people with disabilities would usually go. They would go, for all intents and purposes, into these large-scale, you know, institutional facilities. I think we have to look in a lot of ways, with as challenging as things are in the world and with all the issues that you're seeing on TV and all the problems you think that we're facing, which we clearly are, I think it's okay to step back for just a moment and realize how far we have actually come as a society and as a people. And I think that people who are listening to this program today should be very proud of the work and the things that are happening in our country and in our world. Because 75 years ago, someone like myself would have been recommended for an institutional life, you know, without a huge future, wow, without doing the kind of things I'm doing now. Now let's look at what's happened, kind of, let's look at Michigan. What did Michigan basically say in this last election? Michigan basically said, not only do we not want people with disabilities and special needs living away from us, isolated, wow, and far, we want people with disabilities and special needs to be living amongst us, in our communities, with our families, going to our schools, being in our businesses. And then Michigan decided that it was going to go one next step. And Michigan said, not only do we want people with disabilities living amongst us and not isolated from us, but we actually want somebody with a severe disability to serve as our proxy, to represent us, our needs, our concerns, our desires, our passions, while serving on our highest court. And I think that really tells the story of Michigan, and it tells the story of America. So when you hear about anger and frustration, those are all very real emotions that people have. But we should also look back to the people of Michigan who said, you know what? We are really making tremendous change. We are incredibly inclusive. We want people to matter. We think everyone counts. So and to such an extent, yeah, that they actually said that not only do we want someone with disability just kind of being in the community, but we actually want somebody with disability representing the community.
That's beautiful. But Richard, what do you say, what would be a good example of a case that you think you might be able to share with us that was obviously closed, that was done already, and something that was just an interesting case that came before you as Supreme Court judge?
Well, I think that there's a number of them. I mean, ultimately, you know, I'm just trying to think back to, you know, I can speak about an opinion that I wrote. And it was a very interesting opinion for a young judge to actually have to write. You know, it was a fascinating situation. It took place. It was a case that took place in Jackson County, actually, a wonderful kind of more rural area of our state. And you had a situation where you had a defendant who was on trial, and the defendant had been convicted of a capital offense,
wow,
and was going to be serving his life in prison. And I think what had happened, which was of concern, and I think that what made this a really interesting case was that, and it was a challenge as a young judge to do this, but it was a challenge that I took on because I determined that, you know, ultimately this situation where if the people of the state of Michigan want you to be in this position, they know that you're young, they know that you're going to be a first-time justice, but they're trusting your judgment and your wisdom to try to do the right thing. But what happened in this case, it was a case that for all intents and purposes set the guidelines and parameters within the state of Michigan for what constitutes judicial bias. You know, at what point does a judge go from being a partial administrator of the court proceedings to being an active participant? And, you know, this was an opinion that really helped to define what constitutes a judge going beyond the veil and becoming biased in one direction or another. And that had to be determined, in my opinion, ultimately established all the guidelines and structural standpoints that judges all across the state now have to adhere to. So, wow, for example, if you're
You limited the powers of the court then?
Well, I wouldn't say that it was a limitation. I think what happened was that ultimately, in Michigan, we have a unique kind of ethical standpoint or guide points that judges use, where basically judges are allowed to ask questions, which is somewhat unique. It depends on your jurisdiction as to what judges are able to do and not able to do. So in Michigan, judges are able to ask questions. However, when a judge asks a question, it should really be done to, number one, clarification. You know, it's done to help clarify a question so that the jury can better understand what's being posed. Number two is for efficiency in terms of allowing for the proceedings to continue moving forward. Number three would be ultimately for the ability to maintain control over the courtroom. You know, you can ask a question in order to maintain a certain level of control that is necessary that all judges have to impart upon those who are practicing in the court. And I think in the case that I was handling was the concern was that the types of questions that the judge was asking pierced that veil. And so when you
think it biased the jury?
Well, I think that there are questions that were being asked, and the court felt the questions that were being asked went beyond those three elements and criteria that were allowed. And in terms of the questions that the judge was asking, it ultimately allowed for a bias to become apparent. So the question is that when you have a case like that, you have to go through and define it. And so you use those opportunities. And that's the beauty of being on the Supreme Court, is that you ultimately use the opportunities that are presented. So when a circumstance like this arises, it's really our job and our responsibility to take from that experience and create the benchmarks and create a criteria and create a way of operating for the future to allow for these types of things to not happen. So it was my job to really come up with the standard and develop a standard that is going to be applicable. And then in terms of developing a standard, give the lower court judges a roadmap so that they know what is permissible and not permissible for all civil and criminal matters that come before them so that they can administer the case, but that they know what the grounds of impartiality versus partiality are.
Richard, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about the elephant in the Michigan room right now.
Sure.
Can you say anything about...
You can talk about Flint?
Yeah. I mean, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about that.
Well, of course, I think what Flint shows... Now, again, you know, there is pending litigation, so...
Can I ask a question? What was the question?
Well, the question was about Flint, and
I'm sure most of our listeners are aware of the water situation in Flint, where the city of Flint, and I'll speak
they,
what
they
I
changed,
read.
They changed so you don't the reservoir to, source or something.
Yeah, they changed the reservoir source to try to save money.
It's contaminated.
And it's turning out to be toxic, the water.
So yes. What happened in Flint was that... The city of Flint was going through a financial crisis, and for all intents and purposes, the city was bankrupt. So what occurred was that the governor appointed an emergency financial manager, just an EFM for short. What happens with an EFM is that the EFM takes all the powers away from the elected officials within that governance structure. So the EFM, for all intents and purposes, runs the city. What was then determined was that the EFM decided to change the water source. The water source that Flint would originally use and had used for many, many years was Detroit. And in fact, Detroit has, without question, some of the finest water of the cities all across the... We're actually known for our water purification system.
As opposed to Florida, where you can't even drink the water.
Really?
But it's actually interesting. I mean, Detroit, that's the Detroit Water Department's one of the best water departments in the world. Really? In terms of the cleanest and best product of water that you can possibly find. So what happened was that the city of Flint, in order to save money, stopped purchasing its water from
Detroit,
and then ultimately decided to use as its water source the Flint River. Now, this was a decision that was made by the emergency financial manager, and not by any of the Flint officials, but for all intents and purposes, by the EFM. So then what happened is, as a result was, and this is the kind of thing that the courts are going to be delving into, which is going to really get into the whole question of General Motors actually basically stopped using the Flint water because they found that the Flint water was too corrosive on the machinery within the plant.
Too corrosive for the machinery.
That's correct. So General Motors basically determined that the water coming from the Flint River was far too corrosive.
That's insane.
You know, as it pertained to the machinery that the water has to pass through, and started using other sources of water. So the issue here is for all intents and purposes, is that the people of Flint, you have to understand, the water was brown. It had a very putrid type smell.
They weren't purifying it at all?
Well, the question was that they were not and this was, I think, a pretty interesting component. And again, I'm not commenting as it pertains
just
to...
Just the facts.
I'm just giving you the facts.
Right.
So one of the key facts that was actually brought forth was that the purification or the extra purification that would be necessary would be $100 a day. So if you were to spend that on the extra purification, it was $100. So what happened was that the EFM chose not to do this, and as a result, the water kept being consumed by Flint residents. So obviously people know that lead is something that you have to be very, very careful with, because what lead will do is lead basically can develop tremendous, significant impacts on the brain. So if you drink water and it has coatings of lead that are too high, what it does is it really creates tremendous developmental delay, within young children. It can have an impact on adults as well, but who it really affects are young children, and it creates tremendous developmental delays in terms of their mental processing function. So the issue was that basically this had gone on for quite some time, about a year, and there ultimately it was determined, because there was a wonderful physician in Flint, a pediatrician, who kept noticing these higher levels and problems with behavior with youngsters, and then started commissioning some studies and looking into the issue. And what they found was that the lead and the toxic levels of lead, I mean, it blew off the charts as it pertained to what was permitted and what was not. So now here's where the problem comes in, and I think this is where the issue kind of falls, is that where you stand right now is that Flint ultimately went back to using the Detroit water. So now the water that is coming in from Detroit is clean, pure, good Detroit quality water. The problem is that it has to travel through the pipes that had the corrosive lead. So even though you're getting clean water that's coming from Detroit, because the water system in Flint became corroded with lead, you have to replace all the piping.
Oh my goodness.
And that's the problem, because even though the water now is pure, it's traveling through the corroded pipes. So the question is, now what do you do? Because even though you have a situation where you have to replace the whole infrastructure to allow for the water to be safe to drink. So the courts are going to have to get involved in this.
This is pending, I guess, right?
Yes, and without telling you kind of how I would rule or anything about the various cases that I think are going to come before the court, the courts are ultimately going to have to determine these number of things. They're going to have to determine proximate cause. What is the causation? Is there causation? Is there approximate causation? The courts are going to have to determine, if you own a house, there's going to be all kinds of litigation as it pertains to who has to replace the infrastructure, who is responsible for the infrastructure, who has to pay for it. Is it going to be your homeowner's insurance? Is it going to be the city? Is it going to be the state? Is it going to be the feds?
This is going to be tied up for a long time.
So what the courts are basically anticipating is that, for all intents and purposes, you know, I would say for the next 5 to 10 years, all areas of litigation, because you're talking about future generations that are going to be impacted, that's number one, but you're also talking about an entire infrastructure that now has to be replaced, and who's responsible, how's that going to work, who's going to pay for it, and what is the overall legacy that is that going to establish?
Well, thank you, Richard. This is so exciting. We're talking to one of the most influential people in this country. This person, his decisions, his thought processes impact millions of people in this country. He's a Supreme Court judge in the state of Michigan, and he's a very dear friend to the community. It's Richard Bernstein. We're going to have to take a quick commercial break over here to thank our sponsors, but we'll be right back in just a few short moments. You're listening to The Schmooze, where we're separating the facts from the fiction and the Bubba Mises from the bottom line. It's the rabbi and the CEO. We'll be right back right after this. Don't go away.
Are you retired or nearing retirement? By now you probably realize that nest egg you had set up is not nearly enough to carry you through retirement. Here's some good news. Fortitude Investment Group can help. They specialize in retirement planning, estate planning, income taxation, and investment strategies for people who are retired or approaching retirement looking for ways to maximize their income. It's not too late to get on the right track to financial freedom. Mark Linsky has been a financial advisor since 1986 and carries a certified financial planner's designation and all the tips, tools, and secrets you need to find financial stability. They also focus on 401k plans and passive real estate solutions. So whether you're retired, nearing retirement, or just want to stay ahead of the game, contact Mark Linsky at Fortitude Investment Group today to set up your consultation. 561-328-7391. That's 561-328-7391. Fortitude Investment Group, US 1 and Donald Ross, right in Juneau Beach.
Fortitude Investment Group is an independent firm with securities offered through Summit Brokerage Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services offered through Summit Financial Group, Inc., a registered investment advisor.
Separating the fact from the fiction and the Bubba Mises from the bottom line, you're listening to The Schmooze with the rabbi and the CEO. It's Mitch Zachary, the CEO. I'm Rabbi David Vigler of Chabad of Palm Beach Gardens, and we're bringing you two different perspectives on the Jewish views on the news each and every Sunday morning. Our guest this morning in the studio is one of the most influential people in this country. He's also one of the most inspiring people that you're likely to ever meet. He's blind from birth, but he never, ever allowed that to be
handicap or a disability. On the contrary, he views his inability to see as a heightened awareness and sensitivity and empathy for people. It's Richard Bernstein, who is Michigan Supreme Court Justice, and this guy's got an incredible story. Just hearing him speak is inspiring.
You know, Rabbi, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I think we should talk about some of his other accomplishments, because he just blows everybody away with what he's done.
Richard, can you tell us a little bit about what you do for hobbies on the side? Because that's quite mind-blowing.
Well, thank you for asking. My passion is athletics. I think that athletics...
Remember, he's blind.
Well, and I think athletics really is a symbol of life, and that's why I enjoy athletics. So I've been blessed. I've had the opportunity. I've completed 19 marathons.
I haven't done one.
26-mile marathon.
Yeah.
I didn't do one. Actually, no, as a kid in high school, actually, I did a couple.
They're wonderful.
They were like high school marathons. I don't know. They were
Is usually, so a traditional marathon would usually be about 26.2 miles. So I've been blessed to have the opportunity to have done 19 of those. And then also I completed the Ironman triathlon.
Just one?
Just one.
Why
one? Well, I did do
Why don't you explain what the Ironman is?
Sure. So the Ironman is a 2.4 mile swim, 112 mile bike, and a 26.2 mile run. And the rules of the Ironman are quite simple, that you're not allowed to rest or take a break, because if you do, you'll miss a cutoff time. And if a cutoff time is missed, you're disqualified. So it's a very intense experience, that 2.4 mile swim. You know, you're getting kicked in the face by all the other swimmers. You're the only disabled person in the entire competition. You know, other people can brace for the impact.
How many people would enter this?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, in terms of like how many people would do a traditional Ironman?
Yeah.
Who are just a normal Ironman?
Yeah, totally.
I would say a normal Ironman, it's kind of a self-selecting process, mm-hmm. because when you show up, the people have trained for about a year, 2 years in order to actually do it.
I get tired after like 10 laps.
You would usually have maybe 500 to 600 people, I would say, mm-hmm. 700 people, you know, depending on the Ironman, depending on the circumstance.
Finish? So 700 well, starts. So how many finish?
I would say the vast majority, because it's not, and the reason for that is that it's the kind of thing that you don't just show up for, and right. and I think that it's not like other competitions where people say, oh, I'm going to go out and give us a shot,
right?
Ironman is too hard. Yeah, you show up for that after you've gone through the 2 years of rigorous training that you have to do in order to really be able to present yourself well. I mean, you have to always. My grandfather taught me a really valuable lesson. He said, you know, he gave me a lesson. He said, you know, you always have to have respect for the ocean. You know, meaning that, look, you have to have a respect for certain things. And the ocean can be calm and peaceful, but it can also be fierce. And Ironman's the same thing. It's kind of, you always have to have respect for the challenges that are being brought before you. Because in the Ironman that I did, I remember, you know, we finished it safely and we got through it. It took 14 hours and 36 minutes of continual motion. But, you know, there was a young lady who did the Ironman, and things happen in life. And she was on her cycle, her bicycle, and she fell. And as a result, she broke her neck.
Oh, my God.
So, but that's...
And here you are blind cycling.
Well, but we were, you know, my blessing was that I had an incredible guide. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the way you do it a tandem bike.
So it's a tandem bike.
Right. So you have a guide who is steering.
I was wondering.
Right. So the way that it works is that you have, for the swim, your guide is on a rope. Mm-hmm. And
he has to swim also.
Oh, absolutely. He's swimming right along next to you.
So your guide is doing the Ironman also.
Absolutely. And what happens is that he is swimming right next to you, but you can't communicate with him because you can't hear him.
Right.
So you just have to feel the tug. And when you feel him tug at you, that's an indication to you as to which way you're supposed to go. And then on top of that, you know, it's very complicated because you keep getting kicked over and over. But then the worst part is that other people become ensnared in the rope that connects you to your guide. Wow. So you literally start to kind of drown a little bit because you get dragged below the surface.
Wow.
But I think, look, it's like what Chabad teaches. You know, you're going to have what you need when you need it. You always have to have a peaceful, tranquil approach to how life is. And you kind of roll through it. Because if you panic in that situation...
Richard, that's got to be the most humbling experience. You're in the middle of the ocean.
Well, actually, us was a lake, Lake Coeur d'Alene. Okay. But you're still in the middle of a lake.
2.4 miles is an ocean lake.
It's a big lake.
Down to the bottom is just same distance, you know?
Right.
And you've been kicked in the head.
Right.
You don't know where you are. It's
dark.
I mean, it's like swimming in the nighttime because you don't know where you are.
Exactly.
And there's people all over the place. You got the string, like a tether.
Like a tether around your waist.
Tying you to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And you just got to kind of follow the direction of the yank.
That's correct.
And
What are you thinking? Well, and then the problem is that the people are getting entangled.
Richard, why are you doing this? I mean,
well, seriously, at the end of the day,
isn't that like a terrifying experience?
Yeah, but what are you all about, Rabbi? It's about connection, right? And so at the end of the day, why do people do
connection.
Things? You're always looking for a level of connectivity. It's always trying to find that spirit and that sense of connectivity. And that's really what you do, because at the end of the day, I think that Hashem is always looking to have a relationship with all of us. And so the question is, what kind of a relationship do you want to have? And so in those circumstances and in those situations, I think that's what solidifies the type of relationship that you ultimately will have with the Creator. So when you're out there and you're doing that, it kind of creates a certain level of peace, a certain level of tranquility, because what you always come to find, and what we talked about on Friday, because I really believe this, is that, look, the body is always going to be mortal. But the soul is always what is all powerful. And I think that's the key essence, is that the body will always have mortality. That's the nature of the
right.
human flesh.
Limited.
But it's the spirit that I think can always transcend and present
that's
a
incredible.
Level of power
yeah, really. This
that
is
doesn't
so
ever
inspiring.
Exist.
Yeah, that's a really
that's the
incredible
nature of
statement.
Life.
Mitch, when was the last time that you or I pushed ourselves beyond our limit? Can you think about the
well,
time
let me
of your
tell
life?
You something. You know, based on, you know, what you just said, your soul is incredible. You have the strongest soul.
It's humbling just to
the
listen
koyach,
to
want to push yourself so far. You know, you could easily at any point in your life have said, listen, whatever I do is good enough.
And I'm fed up with God too, by the way.
Yeah, right? You know, you could be angry at God.
But I think it's okay.
And your parents could have been angry at God, right, Rabbi?
For sure. I mean, yeah, why not?
But I think that's okay. You know, it's funny. I always share this story, you know, when you talk to a parent of a special need child. You know, look, you can people have the right to be angry. And to be candidly, I think it's important that people should be angry, because those are real emotions. Those
wow.
are natural emotions.
Love this guy.
No, but if you think about it, look, if you're going to sit there and you're just going to always be praised and happy, then what's going to happen is it's not real. I think the real essence of life, and I learned this when I was in a catastrophic accident, and we spoke about this as well. I was at Mount Sinai Hospital for 10 weeks after getting hit by a cyclist in New York City. And 10 weeks
that must have been, Richard, that must have been scary to wake up in a hospital and not know where you are.
Mitch, just one quick second over here. Just to reset, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to The Schmooze with the Rabbi and the CEO, Mitch Zachary is the CEO. I'm Rabbi David Vigler of Chabad of Palm Beach Gardens, where we provide Jewish traditional Judaism for contemporary Jews just like you. Learn about us online at jewishgardens.com. That's www.jewishgardens.com. By the way, a quick plug for the JLI, Jewish Course of Why, which is starting in just 10 days.
Is that the Jewish Leadership Institute?
The Jewish
Learning Institute?
Yes, Jewish
That's
Learning
a
Institute.
Great program.
The JLI.
That's a People should do that. That's a really good. That's a really good. I don't mean to interrupt, but it's a really good. People really should do that. It's an
Thank
excellent
you so
program.
So much, Richard. The JLI, yeah. The Jewish Learning Institute, is the world's largest Jewish learning group, where you have 30,000 students every semester. It's a six-week semester. 30,000 students is our average in 300 cities across the world, where we are. Our next course is starting in 10 days. It's called the Jewish Course of Why. We polled 30,000 students, and we asked them what are their top most need-to-know questions in Judaism, top 50 questions that you need answers for. And we took the top 50 most popular questions, and we shoved them into one course. It's called the Jewish Course of Why. So every class is about, what's 50 divided by 6? Would be about 8 questions, right?
It's about eight questions every
class. And we just go through them. We just go through from fun and light questions to deep and very touchy, sensitive questions. And in this course, you're just coming out with 50 of the most popular Jewish questions that you need answers for. You can find out that information about how you can join the course that's being offered at the Chabad of Palm Beach Gardens on Wednesday nights and at the JCC here in Palm Beach Gardens on Monday afternoons. It's at www.myjli.com. That's my JLI. JLI is Jewish Learning Institute. www.myjli.com. It's starting in 10 days. And this is absolutely required study for anyone who wants to be educated. You know, if you're out there in the street and you're intellectual and you're educated and you want to talk out of knowledge, not out of sucking things out of your thumb, then you want to be educated. You want to know source materials upon which you can build opinions. For that, you need to come to this course. It's the Jewish Course of Why at www.myjli.com. Starting in 10 days, you got to be educated. And our guest this morning in the studio is absolutely
fascinating and inspiring. It's a Michigan Supreme Court Justice. That's Supreme Court Justice Richard Bernstein. I've known him for about 6 years now, I think.
That's correct.
Since 2011 at the funeral of one of our members, Arthur Cooper.
And you did a beautiful eulogy. You did a beautiful, beautiful eulogy.
Thank you, Richard. You touched that. Arthur was an amazing guy. But thank you, Richard. He's our guest this morning in the studio. He's a Michigan Supreme Court Justice, and he's talking about how he has overcome his challenges in his life. And, you know, we all have challenges. We all have challenges. We all have challenges.
And there's all of us, I'm sure, go through days where we go, I can't take it. You know, it's too much for me. Richard, so if we could just get back to what we were saying before. Despite the issues, you have physical limitations. So you were running in Central Park. I guess you're fairly comfortable with it. Yeah. Walking.
I was walking on the loop. You know, the loop that encompasses East and West Drive and I was in the pedestrian lane and a cyclist was going 35 miles an hour and he struck me in the back.
Wow. So even if you could see, you might not have seen
it. No, right. Absolutely.
And then he asked me, he said, are you blind?
Right. That was, he's quoting the New York Daily News article that the headline was, you know, are you blind? which I thought was the perfect encapsulation of the whole event.
But
I think the lesson that kind of came from that is it was a very intensive experience being at Mount Sinai for 10 weeks. And, you know, you come to learn from those experiences. I really believe that happened for a reason, because those experiences really make you a better judge. I mean, if you're a judge that's lived in a hospital for 10 weeks.
How long ago was this?
It was about 2.5 years ago.
And you're still recuperating.
Oh, absolutely. You always recuperate. You know, it's very interesting. And I think a lot of your listeners and community members will understand. In many situations, you know, when you lose a loved one, when you're going through injury, when you're recovering from illness, whatever it might be, the worst thing that you can say to somebody is, oh, you're going to make a full recovery. Because what that does is it's in a lot of ways, it's very, well, but I think it's patronizing of the difficulties of the circumstance and situation. So when people say, oh, you're going to make a full recovery, most people do not make a full recovery. Wow.
Because for you, it was like being hit by a car.
Correct. 35 mile impact. So what it is that when you're working with someone who's got an illness or the loss of a loved one, it isn't that they're going to recover. And never use the word closure. Closure is the worst word. When someone loses a loved one and you say, I'm going to bring closure, that is offensive. It gets people very upset.
There's no such thing.
Right? There's no such thing as closure, and there's no such thing as recovery. What there is adaptation, which is the people that are the survivors are the people that learn how to adapt. If you're able to adapt to the circumstance, if you're able to adapt to the situation, if you're able to adapt to the prognosis, you have to always think of the word adapt, because if you can adapt, you can survive. But don't focus on recovery, focus on adapting. So for example, I still do marathons, but they're very painful and they're very difficult and they hurt like hell. But so it's not that I'm recovering, I'm just adapting to a new way of life, to a new way of functioning.
Richard, can I just interrupt you a second?
Yes.
Because I'm like, I'm a little uncomfortable with all this, because you're making us all look bad here.
Wait. Can I just go one place? If I could just interrupt you one second.
I'm just trying to swallow all this.
Richard, but one thing I'd like you to share with our listeners is that you made a point of explaining to us, you know, and not to make light of minimize the pain you've gone through because of that.
But mine is minimal compared. I mean, a lot of your listeners have a lot more going on.
So... But the person who hit you, that person also could be traumatized for life, right? I'm sure that anybody that would do that and put somebody could be traumatized for life. Could you please tell our listeners how you dealt with
them? So the issue with that was, look, in every circumstance in life, you want to try to get something good to come from it. And that's that's survivors. People that survive always find the good in a situation. That isn't to mean like, oh, good, like you're those happy people. You try to figure out, okay, there's something positive that's going to come of this. The guy who hit me was a really nice guy. He was a really nice person. He made a mistake. People make mistakes. You know, he lost control. Things happen. That's just the way life goes.
Right. He wasn't intentionally looking
God,
for you.
Oh, God, of course not. This was happened to be a super nice guy who was going at a very high rate of speed who just had a mishap. Life happens. That's not a problem. So the issue was is that, you know, I had no issues with him whatsoever. And I actually told him that. I said, just don't worry about it. Move on with your life. This isn't something you have to be concerned about. Now, the city of New York was different because I did not want any money or anything from the city of New York, but I was destined to turn this into a positive situation. So I did take on the city of New York, not for any money, not for a dime or a nickel, but just to get
Richard, we got just three minutes left over here. So I'm just going to say, I know that you took off the city,
quickly, if you find the purpose in something, Central Park is going to change. There are going to be tunnels. There's going to be new modifications. There are going to be things that are going to happen in Central Park. So what happens is that if you're able to get through something and something good can come out of something tragic, then what ultimately happens is that's where you find your meaning.
You know, I'm so glad you said that because the discomfort I was feeling before, I think you've explained. In other words, you know, we all have challenges. We all have challenges. You know, sometimes you wake up and you got an achy back or something and you feel, I'm never going to be the same again. You know, it's all over. Right. Or you know, if you weren't approved on the mortgage or whatever, you know, you feel that you got problems and you messed up for life.
Well, I'm going to say one quick thing about that very fast, but I think it's a really, really important point. Life is not a snapshot. Trauma patients are the best people to talk to about this. Life is not a snapshot. Life is not one day. You don't look at it like how
it's
you're
a movie
feeling today.
Screen.
Well, it's longer than that. What I always learned from being in the hospital, from being with other trauma patients, was something very simple. If the good days can at least equal the bad, meaning that you're going to have a lot of bad days. A lot of your listeners are going through some tough times, so you're going to have a lot of bad days. If you can have a situation where you have at least one or two good days, and those days are good enough that they can balance out the bad, then that is the totality. Look at life as a totality. Do not look at it. Not a snapshot.
It's dynamic.
So it's all about the totality, which means you can go through a number of bad years, but if you can have one or two good days that allows for some balance, then that balance allows for the totality to interplay.
This is so inspiring.
And the totality allows you to live.
When you've got a challenge,
thank you for that, Richard.
Don't
My pleasure.
Freeze in the challenge. It's not a snapshot. Rather, focus on the purpose of the challenge. There actually is a purpose.
The totality.
In the bigger picture.
Meaning that it's not a mount. You can have 5 years that things have really gone bad. If you can have one day or 2 days that you're able to have something positive or constructive, try to allow that to serve as your balance.
Michigan Supreme Court Justice here, teaching us not only academia, but teaching us ethics and morality. Richard, I can so understand why you were elected by the people of Michigan to become a Supreme Court Justice. God bless you, my friend. May you go from strength to strength. You are so inspiring. I'm so excited to bring you now to our teenagers leadership course. I know that you're going to inspire them now in a few minutes. And I just want to thank you so very, very much for joining us here on Shmooze Radio this beautiful Sunday morning. And I just want, you know, you spoke before about Chabad. I just want to invite our listeners to join us on Wednesday night. We're having a book signing and lecture on a brand new book out there. It's called The Secret of Chabad, Inside the World's Most Successful Jewish Organization by Rabbi David Eliezer. He's from California. And this book is taking the world by storm. It's an expose on the inside of the world's most successful Jewish organization called The Secret of Chabad. This book signing and lecture is taking place Wednesday night at the Chabad of Palm Beach Gardens. Info at jewishgardens.com. That's www.jewishgardens.com. Shalom and have a great week.
Advertise your business on 900 AM, the talk of the Palm Beaches. Call 561-627-9966 today.